Why does it matter to build community in science? Is the relevance of metabolomics in the clinical world region-specific? And how can you navigate the publishing world when establishing new methods in your lab? In this episode, I discuss with Maria Eugenia Monge to answer all of these questions and more as we explore her work and its impact on research in health.
Welcome to Season 4 of the Metabolomist Podcast, where we explore the transformative role of metabolomics and multiomics in advancing the principles of 5P medicine. That is predictive, preventive, precision, population-based, and participatory medicine. I am your host, Alice Limonciel, and this year I will engage with leading scientists and entrepreneurs to uncover how integrative omic strategies are set to revolutionize medical research and also patient care. Join us as we delve into the latest innovations and challenges at the intersection of metabolomics and 5P medicine, shaping the future of research in health. Hello and welcome back to The Metabolomist. Today I am joined by Maria Eugenia Monge. Did I say that correctly? Can you please say your name so that everyone can pronounce it?
Yeah. Softer. The G sounds softer. It's Maria Eugenia Monge.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Thank you very much. So welcome on the podcast. I'm really excited that you're my guest today. I've seen you growing in your presence in the metabolomics community in the last years, and I'm really happy that we get to talk so about your work, of course, and the use that you make of metabolomics, but also about this path you've had in the last few years. I think it's really interesting for the audience, people who know you maybe from LinkedIn or from other communities and also from conferences and from working with you, to understand the path that you've had so far and maybe learn from what you've learned as well. So I'm really grateful that you agreed to join the podcast. And I would ask you to maybe first introduce yourself and where you work and how you got in touch with metabolomics in your career.
Thank you. First, it's a great pleasure. And I also feel very comfortable talking with you because we also shared a Dash Hull experience last year, which was very insightful. I studied at the University of Buenos Aires and I got my PhD in the analytical and physical chemistry field in the area. During my PhD, I already started working with mass spectrometry and my field of work at that time was to investigate the release of flavors that were encapsulated in polysaccharide gels. And I was correlating the release of flavors with electronic gnosis using chemometric tools and characterizing the gels with rheology and also with mass spectrometry, with GC-MS. So already at that time, I was already using multivariate statistical analysis and neural networks, but I was not at all familiar with the word metabolomics. As a postdoc, I had like a very, very different and long experiences abroad. First, I spent some months in Italy. And then I moved to France, to Lyon, where I lived for 4 years working in the field of atmospheric chemistry. So I was restarting again, learning a lot of a new field, but still using mass spectrometry to characterize atmospheric aerosol particles. But now talking about aerosols is something more familiar to the whole world after COVID. But at that time, it was like something new to me, at least, how to understand the chemistry of these particles, how they can have impact, not only on climate change, but also on human health. And when I was living in France, I got the offer to return to Argentina. This was in 2010. I was contacted by the former director of the institute where I'm working right now, that is the Center for Bionanoscience Research, which is a center of our National Research Council of Argentina. And he was in charge of creating a new institution, a new institute here in the country to develop new research lines that were underdeveloped at the moment. And so it was a great challenge because that was the first time we started talking about metabolomics and first applications of metabolomics. And how he also, as a director, conceived the idea of having a group doing mass spec-based metabolomics and another group doing NMR-based metabolomics. And in the future, we would work together. And that is what is happening right now since couple of years ago. It's not very recent, but this was put in 2010. And that's also related with the time challenges of South America, which are sometimes longer, right? I thought that was a very nice offer to return to Argentina. Mm-hmm. It was also a great challenge. So to address that, I moved from France to the United States. And there I worked at Georgia Tech, at the Georgia Institute of Technology, with Facundo Fernandez, who also got his PhD from the University of Buenos Aires. Uh-huh. He's from Argentina. Mm-hmm. But we didn't know each other at the moment. So we first met in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And I worked there for a couple of years, 2 years. And I got a very hard training on mass spec-based techniques applied to metabolomics, mainly on clinical applications. And there I learned a lot more on mass spec because it's a very strong group on mass spectrometry. And I got trained on many different mass spectrometers, different analyzers, also ambient MS techniques, ion mobility spectrometry. January 2014, I returned to my country. And I started to set up a new lab in a new research center that was empty, totally empty. No one pipette, but nothing.
Well, that's a lot of work. Uh-huh.
We had the benches, and that was all. And the hood. Benches and hood. And so, yeah, I mean, I was very lucky as well. But at the same time, in 2013, I had to apply for the position. I was evaluated and so on. And I got the position and I returned in 2014 and I started setting up the lab there in CBION. That's the acronym in Spanish for the Center for Bionanoscience Research. And I started also my research group little by little with a lot of effort because people who joined the group, PhD students and postdocs, didn't know anything about mass spec or liquid chromatography. They were not exposed to the instruments. They knew about the theory, but very little exposure to the instrument. And not even to metabolomics. That was a new word for them.
This has both pros and cons, right? Because you have to train people from the ground up, but then you can also train them in the way that you know how to do the best work.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's very nice, but it takes longer because you start to see like the fruits of the pill that you put in with a longer time. But it's one of the nicest parts of my job right now here in Argentina because since I had the experience of working abroad with other time frames and other speed, for example, regarding buying reagents or spare parts or sending a quotation and receiving a price and getting the product 2 days after that. But here, everything takes so long and there is a lot of bureaucracy. So you have to think and plan a lot in advance. But that's like one of the challenges we face, not only in Argentina, I would say in the region. And that's also one of the motivations that led me not only to train people in Argentina, but also to contact colleagues in South America and start teaching metabolomics and mass spectrometry, not only in Argentina, but also in the region. And that's also how, with other colleagues, through teaching, because that's what was a way of starting the connection, we started thinking about building a network of people doing metabolomics. And finally, this like crystallized in the Latin American Metabolic Profiling Society. But that was later in time. Uh-huh. So I don't know.
What you're saying is the building of LAMP, so this Latin American Society, this came in a way from the need you had at the regional level, so not just in your lab, but at the regional level, to get together, to train people and to organize yourselves. Was that one of the main drivers?
There were several drivers simultaneously, I would say. I think I was in the right time in the country, in Argentina, because in 2014, the first LAMP symposium took place in Peru. And that time I was contacted by a professor here in Argentina who is specialized in NMR, not applied to metabolomics, but mainly to biophysics and proteins. And from the field of NMR, he was in contact with Elaine Holmes. And so it was Elaine and also Coral Barbas who attended this first meeting in Peru. And I always say that Elaine and Coral are our godmothers in terms of helping us to get together.
Mm-hmm.
That was like, that happened in 2014. And then in 2016, Alejandro Vila, who is this colleague in Argentina, organized the second GLAMPS meeting symposium at that moment. It was like a very small community, less than 100 people in Rosario, in the province of Santa Fe in Argentina. And in that year, I met Monica Cala, who is now leading MedCor in Bogotá. But at that moment, she was a PhD student. And thanks to LAMSO. And then I organized different hands-on courses in Sibion, in my institution. And I started inviting colleagues from the region. So Ian Castro Gamboa came to Sibion also. I'm mentioning Ian and Monica mainly because now they will be my co-chairs. You know, in the next Metabolomics Annual Conference.
Yes,
they will take place in Buenos Aires.
Very good.
So, that it's part of the story a little bit, right? How we met, basically based on science and teaching. And Ian also had this spirit of spreading the word, teaching the region, because teaching students would help us to promote and increase the impact of the field in the region. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They are the future. I always say that the young people are the future. And
so I see you have this skill to collaborate and to work together with others. So I understand this happened before the society really existed. So what was the trigger that made you want to form that society?
The trigger, believe it or not, was the Metabolomic Society. And I will tell you why.
Yeah.
Because in 2019, contacted by Caroline Johnson, who was the chair of the membership committee of the Metabolomic Society. And she asked me if I could join the committee so that, because the society had in this strategic plan, one of the goals was to increase the recruitment of members in South America.
Mm-hmm.
And so we started discussing about this. And I contributed, for example, to change the fee structure based on the World Bank index and depending on the income of different countries. And somehow, until that time, we were a network. LAMPS was like a Latin American Metabolic Profiling Network, if you want. And we were not very much organized. But during the pandemic in 2020, we started having virtual meetings, all these key people also in Uruguay, Colombia, Brazil, and Argentina, mainly. And we started having monthly meetings. And somehow we also identified that there was a possibility of becoming an international affiliate of the Metabolomic Society, and that would help us also to gain more visibility.
Yeah.
And to become an international affiliate, we first should have been like a society or something. It was not a requirement, but for us, it was a need to have some formal charter described and on the website with our goals, our challenges. And that's what we did. We ended up writing a charter and we gave ourselves the acronym of LAMPS.
That's how it's done. Yes.
So in like the region.
Yeah. Yeah.
To bring lives. Yeah. And that was a contribution from Julian Witt, particularly, who was at the moment in Colombia working as well. And he also was a very important actor in this at the beginning of the network, because he also participated in the symposium in Peru.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how we ended up getting the name, the acronym, the charter, and then we became an international affiliate of the Metabolomic Society. That was in 2021.
It's really interesting because I always like to ask people how they came about having this kind of community-driven activities. And usually this is how it happens. People start working together at first and then they formalize the thing because they are, of course, in terms of visibility, in terms of communication and in terms of exchange with other societies or other groups, it helps. At the core of it, it's really people who want to work together and who gain from working together. So I think you explained that really well. And maybe to conclude on LAMPS, since we have a bit of platform here, maybe it's interesting for people who are listening and who are in this region, who are not part of LAMPS yet? Like, what's the added value for them?
First, becoming a member of LAMPS mm-hmm. is very simple. Through the website, you fill a form and it's for free. So the registration fee is zero. And the idea is that people get information about the activities that we do, the biannual conference that has been already established, like every 2 years we meet, and to gain exposure through presentation of the work in these meetings, get the possibility of receiving travel awards, because we try to, mm-hmm. typically the LAMPS meetings are very affordable and we try to provide as many travel grants as possible for students from the different countries of the region to participate. That's the spirit of the meeting. And also we typically have workshops for training. And then during the year, like each of the LAMPS members, I would say the founding members, we typically participate in schools, in train, mm-hmm. we organize schools in different countries. Yeah, we are pretty active on mm-hmm. that aspect.
And do you see then the metabolomics community growing through these actions?
Yes. It's growing. The slope is small because there's still limitations in terms of instrumentation, equipment, spread all over these countries. So, but still it's growing and there is a lot of interest, not only in clinical applications, but South America is very rich in terms of agricultural products, natural products, mm-hmm. species, characterizing species. We have like so many forests and oceans. For example, now in Argentina, there have been so many findings of the ocean in the coast that have been mm-hmm. on our social media. And that's all our researchers from CONICET. Mm-hmm. And I'm mentioning this because particularly these years in Argentina, have been a little bit harder in terms mm-hmm. of the role that science plays. Like some people have seem to have forgotten about that. And this type of discoveries turn on the light on everyone. And they say, oh, wow, that's marvelous how people are can mm-hmm. have this type of discoveries and how we can contribute to the civil society.
Okay, so there's a kind of communication about science that is making people reconnect with science.
Exactly. It's so important. And that's mm-hmm. something that Pedro Aramendia, who was the former director of CIVION, he's now retired. But mm-hmm. I remember when I returned to Argentina, he said, one of your goals is to teach and to transmit this knowledge. Mm-hmm. And I would add to that, that it's not only important to teach students and researchers, but also to communicate to the civil society, so that everyone understands the value. And I would say that we always have to be able to communicate the relevance and importance of science to the community all the time.
And I think it also helps to put your own work in context. I think when you start to look at it through the eyes of the people around you who are not scientists, it also makes you sometimes question, like, are these projects as relevant as others? And maybe that helps to make certain decisions as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that takes us nicely to the transition you've made. So you've mentioned that you worked in, like you applied analytical chemistry to many different fields. And today you work primarily in the clinical field, right? So applying mass spectrometry in the clinics or for clinical applications. So what's different there?
I would say that clinical applications have been the most important, like in our research group. We have also had some environmental applications based on my past experience, some impacts on studying the marine biology and impacts on formation of aerosols, but mainly clinical applications. And that's where we engage also with 4 different hospitals in Argentina and biobanking systems. And because I'm confident that metabolomics and MS-based techniques can be transformative for improving disease diagnosis, disease prognosis, treatment, drug development. There are so many strengths of metabolomics that we are seeing examples in the literature, in the community, but we have still many challenges to overcome. Yeah. But the relevance and the potential of if we call metabolomics a tool or a field is so high.
What is it that makes it so relevant in your opinion? Why is it particularly relevant as a technique?
Overcoming so many limitations that classical analytical techniques that are typically used on the clinical setting would be one of them. I would give one example that is a particular work in which we have been working on in the last years, and then I can provide other examples from other projects. But this is a particular case that is mainly the development of a target assay to quantify 8 steroid hormones in serum samples from patients under 3 months of age. So neonates and also pediatric patients who suffer from adrenal and gonadal disorders. So in Argentina and in many labs in the world, I would say like if you consider all countries in the world, most labs use still immunoassays, even if this may not be anymore the gold standard in some central countries. If you see the world and if you take...
Why is that, you think? Is it because people like to stick to a method they already know? Or is it because they don't easily have access to something new?
I would say it's related, yes, to technical ease, the cost, the availability of the reagents also. The commercial reagents are easily available, less expensive. And there is a know-how on using mass spectrometry that it's still not, it has still not reached all the countries in the world. We are so used to seeing statistics and data in the international conferences from northern countries or central countries, not even in the northern hemisphere, because there are central countries that are not only in the northern hemisphere, but typically data arises from central countries, right? But the world is not just central countries. That's where we need to also change our mindset a little bit and try to see how we can contribute in other regions and how. And that's why this particular essay that we developed, we had a hospital in Buenos Aires that is a pediatric hospital, one of the most important in the country, that acquired a mass spectrometry instrument coupled to a UHPLC instrument. But they didn't know how to use it, so they had this instrument. They were using it, but they knew that they were suffering from many limitations, and they had a gap in knowledge and training. Yeah.
So they wanted to use this advanced technology, but they didn't have all the expertise.
Exactly. And they had a beautiful lab. The instrument was set up in a beautiful environment. But that is where you see that you not only need as a pillar the technique, but you also need the human resources, the trained human resources and the technique. So like both things have to move forward in parallel, which is a challenge, but also for the countries and for developing countries, because it's not only about money and it's not only about buying instrumentation, but it's also about training people, which also requires money, but it's a different aspect. You cannot buy knowledge in terms of like...
And it takes money and time, which is, I think people are not always ready to invest.
Yeah. And time, exactly. So there has to be a plan. That's what I mean. You need to plan things so that they can crystallize or like accommodate in the perfect time or moment and with people and the technique. And that's it, like one of our contributions that I think was very relevant for my country, because we developed this assay with UHPLC, APCI, and tandem mass spectrometry. And now this is the first assay that is currently implemented in the clinical setting for diagnosis, improving the diagnosis of the pediatric patients. The assay was developed and validated following FDA, EMA guidelines. And for us,
And it's the first assay for these applications in the city, in the country?
In the country.
Wow.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a huge achievement. And so we discussed that in preparation for the episode recording. And you told me, so you have a paper that you wrote with your collaborators, right, where you describe all of this. Mm-hmm. And this is now the first episode of The Metabolomist where we're discussing the paper, but I haven't seen the paper because it hasn't been published yet. Can you tell us a bit about that?
It hasn't been published yet because it has been a hard road. as many things that happen to us in this region, like these are like maybe the low boys challenges that people don't talk too much about. We started the process of submission last year, but like to a particular journal, and we got the feedback that was saying that there were many other essays for quantifying steroid hormones in biospecimens in general. Even if there is very little data for neonates about these compounds, there is very, very little. But the general feedback was like there are other methods out there. So this work lacks of novelty.
Novelty. Mm-hmm. And did that surprise you? Did you find it unfair, or did you find maybe it had other merits that would complement that?
I typically try to understand and improve from the feedback of reviewers, because that's how the peer review system works, mm-hmm. and how it enriches the work of others. And even the feedback was the work has very good quality, but still you need to emphasize where the novelty mm-hmm. is.
But did they give you then advice on how to improve the novelty level, or did they just say?
Oh, we received a couple of suggestions mm-hmm. regarding, okay, are you working with a simple sample prep? And that was the case. It was a very simple sample prep. We were using four-fold less sample volume than what is required typically for immunoassays, because typically in immunoassays, you have to do one immunoassay for each compound. It helped us to, like, in a revised version, to improve, the way in which we were communicating this novelty. But for us, the main aspect that was, like, mm-hmm. not maybe identified by my colleagues is that this is the first essay that is implemented already in the clinical setting in Argentina that is helping a lot of families.
And I mean, that application is rewarding itself. But of course, as scientists, when you develop the methods, you also want to be able to publish about it and to share it also with others who might want to use it here in the same region or even in completely different parts of the world, right?
And the method is new. It's not that we copy-paste something that was out there. So basically, also a suggestion was like, all the method sections has to be removed and just make it a report, a small report, and not an original research article.
Okay.
We had like different suggestions and we ended up submitting to a new journal because that was finally also a recommendation.
This is interesting.
I didn't have to change the target.
This is interesting because when you get that feedback, of course, I guess you consider, are they right? And should I repurpose this story, or do I stand by the view that I have of that work and do I continue? And it's not the first time that a paper is rejected and then submitted to other journals. But I understand from talking with you previously also that this was unexpected because you did see certain levels of novelty, that maybe that reviewer was expecting a different kind of novelty. Maybe they've been doing this in a different way for many years and they think the method itself is not as novel. But I can imagine there's a level where someone who would probably be working in a different country with in different context would not grasp what is really so novel about that paper. I think it's a really interesting case to see those differences. And this is why I wanted to discuss that paper with you, even though I have not seen it. But we will see it soon, I'm sure.
And what is interesting is that we, following all these advices, we submitted to a different journal. And one feedback that we had was, oh, please include all the method sections in the main manuscript, which is the opposite one that we were requested by other colleagues. So it's a mixture because, you know, there are some always each journal has editorial guidelines and different, and typically we read as authors the guidelines before submitting a manuscript. But we as authors were also shaping the way in which we were telling our story so that people would receive it according to the feedback that we received. Mm-hmm. Because the ultimate goal for us is to share this with the community. We don't mind if we put it in a way or another. The important thing is that the information is out there and we can share it. And we can show that, for the smaller community who works in adrenal disorders that are not all of them experts in mass spectrometry. There are many biochemists or pediatricians that may also learn about these additional ways of methods of for determining these compounds and helping to diagnose patients.
Yeah. It's really interesting. And so through that process, I mean, you're not completely through it, unfortunately, but no. Listen, what would you say is the main learning you made? Because, I mean, you can see many different aspects. Of course, there's the aspect where, you adapt to some extent, but there's also maybe aspects where you want to keep working on changing the way that such manuscripts are received or such stories are received.
There is always a balance, and it's so... so curious that the same person having an affiliation in a different country has a different impact on the reader. And that I experienced myself this in other examples as well. I also work in the States, in France, but it's always me. It's the same person.
Yes. And you feel that makes a difference when you're affiliated to the university from a different country.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, I think this happens with researchers from other countries as well, not mm-hmm. only in South America.
Yeah.
But this is something.
Yeah. No more Pavel.
That's why I'm here. It's the world in which we live.
But I think so, as listeners listen to this story, I think there will be many people who will relate to what you just said. So I would encourage them to get in touch with you, or if they're in South America, again, to South and Latin America, to get in touch with LAMPS, because I think this is also as more voices raise the same issues and the same stories, then
and I'm always, that's why I'm always mm-hmm. defending the flag of education and training, because if you read a work and it's correctly conducted, all the quality control practices and every methodological aspect is well described and can be reproducible, that's an effect of training and education as well. So then you have the resources or the evidence to defend your work. And that's what I insist on my students, that we always learn from the peer review process, and I very much appreciate. And in these days, it's very difficult to, there has been a crisis to find reviewers and find people that accept to review manuscripts, because people are overwhelmed with work. And I don't know what happened after the pandemic. Mm-hmm. We have much more work than before. And that's why I was saying, what I insist on my students is we need to do as much as we can in terms of when we do, for example, on target metabolomics, and we need to identify these discriminant compounds that are going to be relevant in biology. I say, let's do as much as we can to identify with the highest confidence level possible. Let's aim to level one, to all the compounds that we can, so that we can tell a story and really be confident on our results and provide the most accurate biological interpretation as possible based on these ideas. Mm. And I always said, we need to show others that our work is valuable and that others can reproduce it. So
I guess that comes from your work in MQAC as well. That's one reason why you're part of that group. Yeah.
I think that's a great initiative. I joined MQAC in February 2019. Mm. And I'm proud of being a member of MQAC because I think that all the publications that have come out from MQAC, and not only publications, but also workshops and poster presentations and all the material that is out there, and we are now working in the best practices working group on a leading guidance. Mm-hmm. That's valuable for the community because I, like as a reviewer also, I've seen many manuscripts in which, for example, the word hasn't used a blank. And how can you solve that? And that's the lack of training and education. Mm-hmm. And that because there are so many resources invested in that essay and time and money, and that's maybe lack of education and training. Mm-hmm. That's why I emphasize a lot about that. And that's why also part of being in LAMPS, I would say that's like one of the missions.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, I think maybe we can make also a nice transition to the last topic, which is 5P medicine. So this idea of preventive, predictive, precision medicine, population-based medicine, and participatory medicine as ways to massage the new tools we have, including metabolomics, into the clinics and to medical practice. So you work with LAMPS applied in the clinics already, but you have probably, I'm sure, lots of other projects than the one you discussed where you do that work already. So for you, do you see one of those 5Ps being most relevant for your work? And if so, why?
Yes. For my work, I would say preventive mm-hmm. medicine and predictive medicine. And
why particular?
Personalized medicine would be like goals that we are want to achieve. And we have worked quite a lot in clear cell renal cell carcinoma. Mm-hmm. And something that lacks in those works that I would love to have is like more communication with oncologists so mm-hmm. that there is this clinical translation as well to validate the results in other cohorts, in other countries, with patients from other ethnicities, mm-hmm. diet, etc. So it's in the biomarker discovery field, I see that there is this lack of validation essays that mm-hmm. I don't know if it is due to a lack of funding for this type of projects because they are not discovery related but more like validation related, or if I don't know why there is this lack of mm-hmm. validation essays to see what like from the different potential biomarkers that are out there, mm. which would be really impacting a general population, or if we have to think about different phenotypes mm. associated with different ethnicity.
Yeah, types. And this takes us then to the value of population-based medicine exactly. as well, because exactly. you have a broad population, then you break it down into subgroups, and I start to see which markers are relevant.
Exactly. Yeah. And also,
it's hard to separate those 5Ps, isn't it?
Exactly. Exactly. And then there are different scales. Like, for example, my lab has handled, I would say, up to around 500 samples from patients, but not, we don't have access to large biobanking systems as in mm-hmm. other countries. Mm-hmm. But now, for example, we are starting a new project in pulmonary idiopathic fibrosis, which is very exciting for me because in this project, I'm starting from the very beginning a collaboration with a pneumonologist and medical doctor who is a key opinion leader on this field, and he does research. And that's also very interesting because mm-hmm. sometimes you need this commitment. And it's an unattended disease, it's a rare disease mm-hmm. based on the incidence. And we have access to these valuable patient samples. We will see if we can contribute with new biomarkers for improving prognosis mm-hmm. and diagnosis.
Yeah, that's really exciting. Uh-huh. Is that where you see where you expect the biggest impact of metabolomics in the next years? Is it these biomarkers? Is it distinguishing between better markers for different populations, or is there a specific thing that you kind of dream of that metabolomics could bring?
When I first started working in the field, I was dreaming that in the future, when you get a blood sample for a traditional clinical assay, the typical check that you do, the annual check, you would get not only cholesterol and glucose, and but expand it to a panel and see how this could be informative about different diseases, or if this could be provide with information for,
So almost towards systems biology, I guess, to really bring the pieces together.
That was my dream when I started. Then, you know, you have big dreams and then you start to like, okay, this is the reality. This is what I have. Let's start contributing with our study. But always the big dreams are the drivers also. And, and I think that needs to happen. Like this translation of metabolomics into the clinical setting has to happen, and it will happen. I think.
You think so too?
A little bit of, or there are some barriers still related to the reproducibility of the methods, and that's why MQAC plays a big role, and that's why the Metabolomic Standards Initiative played a big role. But it seems that still the community has to be able to adopt certain practices so that we could all benefit from the work of others.
Yeah,
which at the end, I would say that's the spirit of doing science, contribute with something that can help others as well.
Yeah, and it's part of the fun as well.
Yeah.
To work with people who know how to do something you don't and then make something better together. That's the part I like the most. I think we're reaching the point where you could tell us about your favorite metabolite if you're ready.
Yes, I had to think about that. And then when I gave a couple of minutes and said, oh, glucose. Why? So many reasons.
All right, let's hear them. I'm interested.
But glucose. Well, it's the typical metabolite that is measured in a clinical assay. Mm-hmm. And it's so powerful because it's so highly regulated. It can provide information about health and disease. It's involved in so many metabolic pathways. But also, it was the first metabolite that I had to develop a target quantitative assay like more than 13 years ago. It was for an application on cystic fibrosis at Georgia Tech. And I developed the method using a UHPLC QTOF mass spectrometer, a UHPLC trolling wave ion mobility mass spectrometry, and a UHPLC triple quadrupole mass spectrometry. So I developed three different methods with different...
And you still like glucose after that?
And I still like glucose. And at the beginning, it was caramelizing in the ion source. So it seems a very simple compound. It has some challenges. And actually, during the PhD, I worked with polysaccharides for building gels. And I had to characterize with NMR all these polysaccharides and with mass spec. And that was also, I use MALDI-TOF at the moment. And nowadays, we are also involved in a completely different project that is related to honey authentication for developing untargeted metabolomics methods for finding potential biomarkers of fraud. Honey is also full of polysaccharides and glucose. And glucose is needed for every living species, right? So it's kind of a key compound. So there are many reasons. That's why there are many reasons.
Thank you very much. And thank you again for joining the podcast and for sharing your experiences. And yeah.
Thank you so much, Annie. Hopefully this also helps others.
Yeah, I hope so too. I think it's always the beauty of sharing your experiences that there are people with whom it will resonate. And this is why I like to do this, actually. Thank you for joining us for today's episode of The Metabolomist, where we uncovered new ways in which metabolomics and multiomics are driving breakthroughs in 5P medicine, the powerful framework that's shaping the future of healthcare. If you enjoyed this conversation and want to stay updated, subscribe to our newsletter at themetabolomist.com to be the first to know when our next episode drops. Until then, I hope you get to keep exploring the fascinating world of metabolomics.